near Skagway. And so he spent some time there, and the Krupp Company of Germany took an option on it just prior to the outbreak of war with England, which occurred in late in 13, early in 14, and pretty good royalty basis. When Germany and Britain started their squabble, now this is right on the border between Canada and Alaska, and they didn't know where the border was at that time. It wasn't until quite a few years after that that the boundary was established. But Britain then had more control over Canada than it does now, and they knew pretty well what was going on. And they brought proceedings early in 1914 and had these claims tied up for years and years and years, well, until 1922. And so it was just practically forgotten. And my nephew recently went in and re-established ownership of these. But they claimed that it was on Canadian soil, therefore it was under jurisdiction of the British, and it was tied up by injunction. And that had a small influence. When I say I'm sure it had a small influence, it might have had a larger influence, on establishing monuments between Canada and Alaska, cooperative with the two governments. And which reminds me of another little incident with regard to this boundary. Most of the monuments, they carried in by pack board or by pack animals and boats and whatever method they could. The Arctic cement came from down the Mackenzie and then to Herschel Island, and Herschel Island this way towards the head of the Old Crow and a lot of it went up the Porcupine River into the Old Crow to get to the boundary, and Mount St. Elias, I think, is pretty close to that boundary down on the coast.
I hear a car. Oh.
No. But anyway, these monuments tipped over. Cement was different than they make it today. And cement contained a lot of rather raw type lime. Any cement will kind of weather. But the wild animals come in there and they go to lick for this lime, and pretty soon they undermine, which most of it is on the ground where they can get it, and they undermine these, and about, well, I know up the Porcupine, most of them are laying one way or another, you know, where the animals are dug out under there. All the animals are, but they need that mineral, that calcium and the salty taste, of course.
So
rather interesting. I don't know whether people pay any attention to it or not.
Well, I always like this sort of thing, so I mean, I have.
But if somebody was to happen to examine those, they'd wonder why they're always tipping over, you know. Oh, it's during the frost or something. Well, it probably had some influence, but first, animals kind of.
So then did your dad, when at the outbreak?
He went to Dawson and fiddled around there, and then he came down to Circle for the Barry Hamlin Company. There was an article in the paper recently about Barry Hamlin people. And he hunted for them and helped establish claims and so forth for a couple of years. Came into Fairbanks, liked it. A couple of boys down there where Wainwright is now. There was an island, and altogether there was 300 and some acres of land, and these two boys were going to homestead it. And he, in 1904, bought them out and homesteaded. Didn't get patented until, oh, I don't know, a long time after that, because he had too much waterfront, you know.
Oh,
a lot of silly things like that. And, yeah, that has been the home ever since. And he went to fur buying and everything, freighting and...
And you helped him on all this? Well,
I was pretty young, you know. But us kids had to learn to do things. We lived out of town. We were isolated some time of the year, like break up and about freeze up time. Mm-hmm. And well, it didn't have the roads like you have now. You know, transportation was. You had to be by a river or a stream, or you had to be where you could navigate in the wintertime easily without having to build a bridge or something, you know. And, he was interested in politics, and he was a pretty good public speaker, and he liked to take issue with anybody.
That sounds like a good and interesting influence.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he was, I never heard of anybody who didn't have a lot of respect for him. Unless it might have been a judge or somebody. Oh, yeah, there's several little incidents there that even a short period ago, very famous judge. You could just see that. Oh, your family, you know, damn you. Oh. But to me, it's laughable.
Oh, it's wonderful. Just wonderful.
I was in charge of putting on a benefit one time, smoker. And I mispronounced a word. Start of this program, I made a little announcement of why a smoker was taking it, and actually it was for a benefit for the hospital, for the old St. Joe's Hospital. And we had a real nice card. Bud Myers, a real estate man, he was, and another one that sells Encyclopedia Britannica, he was on the show. He had a chief of police, and Johnny Butterwich had his first and I think only fight as a fighter on that particular show. But I made a little talk there to the audience, and I used the word that it will bring out, this sort of contest will bring out the latent powers. It's not latent, it's latent. Mm-hmm. After the program was all over, Johnny got staggering around where they had to stop the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And an Indian boy went on to become quite a fighter. We just outclassed him. And the president of the University of Alaska, who at one time was a U.S. judge here in Fairbanks, who didn't like my dad. They were opponents, in other words. And came up to me, and I remember he had to... scarf, no hat on and a scarf. I was surprised to see him there, you know. I figured, my God, this is second-class operation. And just the common people supposed to be the smoker. And here he was. He come down, shuffled down there, and he had slippers on. Feet always bothered him. And put that big scarf wrapped around his neck. And he says, Busby, I'm ashamed of you. And he went on and he just bawled the hell out of me. Anybody knows better than to make such a terrible mistake.
Did he ever tell you what it was?
Well, I asked him. I says, Judge,
what have I done?
I says, Judge, what is it now? What is the problem? I was young and kind of cocky then too, you know. And he said, well, you used, misspelled the word latent. Or latent. And I says, it startled me. I says, did you understand what it was? Well, I certainly. I said, well, and if you can understand it, anybody else should be able to. And that ended it. And you could just see the fire in it. Oh, boy. His daughter, he had one daughter, Jean Bunnell, was a real swell classic girl. She used to sit in front of me in school. And in two different, 1 year and part of another. And if it hadn't been for her helping me once in a while, I don't think I'd have got the first base.
Mm-hmm.
But she was what her dad was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother was very nice. I don't know what the problem was, but they kind of separated. And Jean was in here a few years ago. Well, that was 1921, was the last time that I seen her. Never thought of her, you know, until here one day she popped in here. Wanted to know if there was a rope or something that they could tow their car. They broke down out here.
For heaven's sake.
So they happened to have a rope, and so she stayed here and visited with the kids and the family and so forth. And well, they towed the car in and got it fixed and came back. And kind of interesting. You know?
Oh, yeah, very. So you did get to school some, I guess what impresses me about you, and I don't like the word impress, you know, I mean, it's just for lack of another term, is I think that from my definition of intelligence is not altitude but spectrum. And, you know, I'm very impressed with the spectrum. And here, you've had relatively little formal education to that extent.
Yeah, well, I had...
But you did it on your own.
I had no, not on my own. I think it was just excellent help.
Mm-hmm.
People that knew how to teach, I think is the thing. We have lots of teachers today. My God, the world's full of them. But they are in a category of where they are specializing in one particular thing and they don't know a damn thing about anything
mm-hmm,
else.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but most of them. Like Robin down here teaches kindergarten, and it's a special, she can take any little kid and they can know what words mean and how to spell them and put them in the right place and all that when they're real small. And as a kindergarten teacher, she is, you know, wonderful. But she doesn't know anything about anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Ronnie's Alaska history and American history, and my golly, sometimes I think he doesn't know anything but that. So this is the thing. But when you have, especially like a mother and dad that had gone through so many experiences, and everything was of great interest, and family was so important, and if there's anything that they knew that could benefit you, it was available to you for you to accept or reject. That's the thing that I believe was so important. Now, we had exceptional teachers in our school. I went through fifth grade here in Fairbanks. I think it took me 7 years, something like that. But I was always in trouble. I know I 2 years in the first grade, I was out more than half of this year with illness. And I was out in the woods until late, well, until after the freeze-up with the folks. In second grade, went into third grade, and the teacher, we just clashed. And the kids didn't like me. One of our teachers was insisted that you know how to write. Oh.
That just happened
to be. So penmanship was so important. Fancy. And I remember we were, Betty and I was at Pioneer Celebration here a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, and there was one of the old family boys, a boy from one of the old families that was in the same grade with me, one of the years, got kind of tanked up with beer or whatever they were serving on the side, came over and put his arms around us and started in talking, and you know, I never have a chance to talk to you since we was going to school as kids, but you know how I hated you? Because I didn't like most of the other kids in our class. You was the only one that was allowed to use a pen and ink, and we had to use pencil.
Oh, is that right?
Isn't that odd?
You see? All these years.
All those years.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know why. Yeah. And this was not just that boy, but the whole family, you know. How, when they are busy thinking about something like that, they miss so much of what's going on in life. But that startled me to think that they would hold a grudge. But on the other hand, I thought, well, nothing to stop you, you know, to have learned a little something about penmanship. Most of that family is dead now, too. They were real nice people.
So then what happened after grade five?
Well, we went to the States. I didn't go to school anymore that year.
What did you do? Just went down for a year?
No, we was... my dad was supposed to inherit a considerable amount of money. And we got out there and he turned it down. There was too many stipulations. Mm-hmm.
Happens a lot too.
Huh?
But there's nothing so such thing as a gift.
Oh yeah, we sold our place here, old ranch, and my brother, next oldest brother, a girl that was here the other day, her dad was in the summertime was up and down the Yukon in boats, and. My youngest sister, my older sister, was married and over in Fort Yukon at that time. And youngest sister was telephone operator here in Fairbanks. My oldest brother, Ronnie's dad, was, I think at that time that he was... Oh God, I don't quite remember what he was doing. He was always, he was a cartoonist by trade. Mm-hmm. Pretty good musician, but too easy, you know. He do something that where he got more action and not so much money. I think that he was in charge of the experimental station out here at at the college at that time. I think he was. He wasn't the superintendent, but he was in charge of some phase of it. He usually had a director and then, I don't know, it's kind of a long, drawn-out affair, you know. You've got to have a lot of bureaucracy in federal jobs. And,
so then you came back up here as a family?
Well, I went to school out there for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I also took special courses. Now, we couldn't have the help of our teachers that we had here that once a week would always be there to see what you're a damn dummy, whether you've learned anything or whether you could remember anything. And so we missed so many things. I was going to high school in Compton, California. And there was 2,500 kids there, and I learned less during that season.
Yeah.
Oh, that was such a waste of time. So I took night school. Then I went to art school in La Mita.
Mm-hmm.
And the high school was in Compton. Not far from Watts, a very famous Watts. I had a lot of funny experiences there. And then I went up to Sacramento, where our family lived. Dad had come north to repossess our property, which he did. And we cut loose of the property we had down there, which is, I was always glad we did, because almonds and fruit trees and things like that, just waste of time as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But I won a little scholarship to Davis,
mm-hmm.
University of California, Davis, and that was kind of a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say that. Because you learn something.
Yeah, you learn.
But I cut that out. Now, I condemned the kids one time thoroughly, as Betty would tell you probably, for turning down, three of them had scholarships here at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one could have had if it wanted, I guess. And I kind of went after one of them because he quit it and went to Anchorage and then went on his own to Los Angeles. That's the boy that called today.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a real good education. I mean, top quality, you know, but he'd done it the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I'd done the same damn thing myself, you see. And a dollar in those days was quite a lot different than what they would be now. So I shouldn't condemn them on anything at all.
So then you came to...
Then we came north. I went to... They were going to colonize the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started in... We went up to Oregon and bought a place in Tillamook, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother and his oldest daughter just revisited there this spring. And they took some pictures, and it looks worse than it was when we were there. Oh, gee, what a dilapidated layout. House, a new house, but everything else had just gone to pot. And but the road, you know, still a damn little broken fence like around the roads like it was when I was there in the early days. Well, I had a chance, an offer to, if I would learn how to make cheese, I could be in charge of a creamery, and they had a creamery on a railroad cars. And they didn't know whether to have it at Anchorage or here, or they would maybe go between here and McKinley Park. And I thought, my God, that's it'd be a good job. Because Dad was a great stockman. He, anywhere he went, if he didn't have some stock, why, there's no use anchoring. If it wasn't horses, it was cows or something, you know. And, he even had the chicken ranch one time in California, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing about that was we learned why it was that when you got lots of eggs, the price goes down and vice versa, you know. That's the only thing we learned about that. Well, so we started in buying stock. Now, they have beautiful stock around there. It's dairy stock. Mm-hmm. Naturally, we'd have to have dairy stock because we want to help this cheese factory along, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so, area that was all in this Tillamook Dairy Association making Tillamook cheese. That's all they done.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd take this fine stock, and as soon as it was born, why, after a day or two, why, they'd knock it in the head and bury it.
Oh, that's awful.
So we'd buy them up for a dollar or two a head, you know, and we soon had about, I think we had around 60 heads altogether, something like that. And we were going to use the colonization program to bring them up here. So I went to work, and we landed there from California by car late in the afternoon, and I had a job that same night.
Mm-hmm.
To go to work the next day in the South Prairie Creamery on the Trask River, one of the larger creameries.
Mm-hmm.
And that was real good pay compared to what other people was getting. For every 10,000 pounds of milk that came to the creamery, why, they'd have one man. Otherwise, it would be, less than 10,000 pounds that would come in daily, why, there would be a head cheesemaker, and he'd mm-hmm. be handling the whole thing alone. 20,000 pounds, they'd have one man, and so on. So, I forget how many there was worked there. I think there was 7 or 8 of us all together. And I worked there until fall, learned a lot about making cheese. Curing,
mm-hmm.
everything from building the boxes to put them in to the scrubbing down early in the afternoon so everybody could go home quick, and setting rent and everything else for the following morning. And it was interesting.
So then what happened? Did you just...
Then about the time I... When the season, as the season progressed, or in the fall, why, milk dropped off because they would let the cows rest in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a vacation. Most of the people were Swiss there.
Mm-hmm.
I say most of them, the ones that were daring, most of them. And interesting people, some real nice people. And so there's nothing to do there in the wintertime, and a person should have a good fire and a good warm place, you know, and good books to read, but nobody done that.
But how old were you then?
Huh?
But how old were you then?
Oh, gee, I don't know.
You just guess.
Oh, I was 16, I guess,
okay.
Somewhere along in there, 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
Age is something that just...
Well, it's irrelevant, really, for a thing like this, yeah.
But, now in order to fill in the year, why, you have to have something. You can't lay around there because it's storming there in the winter. It's most miserable then.
Mm-hmm.
If one of those old-timers there, if it wasn't raining, you know, so you're wet, why, I don't know what's going to happen here. Everything's gone to hell. They're cutting the timber off and it's not raining, you know. They're just used to it. And those people, you know, Oregon is good enough for me, and they've never been out of the county, you know.
Oh, I know.
Isolated anyway,
yeah.
There in that country. But the following year, well, I went from creamy to creamy. Whoever was win the prize, that was... But I was after work where the prize was made. They compete all over the world, you know. And this Long Prairie Creamery, which was a one-man operation, had won the honors that year, so I worked with him the following season.
Mm-hmm.
And long enough to get formulas and all, you know, pick their brains. And then it came time to head north. About that time, we have all this stock, get all arrangements made, and the colonization program fell through.
Oh.
I don't know what they ever done with the creamery. It was on the railroad at McKinley Park area the last I seen it. And then they took up political deal, you know, and they brought people from Wisconsin, Minnesota, and a few places like that. And that was it.
So that left you sort of high and dry.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. What did your poor family, what did your family do?
We got here to Fairbanks and got the stock unloaded and organized. And Dad was recovered from a stroke that he had. Awful, but he'd never been ill a day in his life by that. And he wasn't about to
sit
down. That's important in a stroke or a heart attack or anything else. So I befriended a Russian on the steamer. And he was a fellow by the name of George Blonsky. He was a titled White Russian that 1918, he was a very young man, and they started to get out of the Russian area, and they got on a Trans-Siberian Railway and ended up in Mugden, China. Mugden, China. And him and his grandmother was the only ones left. The rest of them had all been beheaded or something because they were titled. And through the Young Russians Refugee Association, they brought him in and put him through Boston Institute of Technology. And he was to graduate that spring. And he had a chance to come to work for the USSNRM, which is a FE company out here that was building the powerhouse and dredges and so forth. And he had money enough. He left school early. And he had money enough to either eat to come to Fairbanks or go and see an opera. And he chose to see an opera before leaving down there. So he was pretty hungry on the ship. And he was coming up steerage. Well, in order to water this stock, you had to use a little tomato can in the crew's quarters and go up and down, fill the buckets and up and down, and finally end up and let them down in the bilge of the rope, in the bilge in hatch number 3.
Nightmare.
Oh, terrible. Most miserable. And it takes a lot of water for the stock that we had. So my dad would climb down the ladder, and I'd rustle people out of the steerage, and this boy, he just wanted to work because 50 cents an hour was big money. Oh my God, that was big money, and that's what I paid him. So he thought that, boy, you're a wonderful person. So I'm coming down the street after getting the stock unloaded. My brother, my oldest brother then, had the farthest north steam laundry in the world. And I was headed down to see him, and who do I meet on the street but this Blonsky. And he's got a new clothes on, and he's all decorated up as an engineer. And he says, my friend, you know, and he could talk pretty good English. Do you want a job? I said, well, sure, I'm always looking for a job. I had a job with the stock. And he says, come with me. And he went over, and before I knew it, I realized I signed up as one of his, one of the three members he's allowed to hire for his crew, as a I signed on as an axeman on his survey crew. And I went on to learn about...
How marvelous! I mean, what a great opportunity. How wonderful.
Levels. And
yeah.
So we went out, snow on the ground, and all that sort of thing. We went out to what is now known as Kokomo on the Chattanooga River, and we took over a residency where somebody had, was supposed to be operating and didn't show up or got sick. And so we was running the beeline for the ditch along the edge of the hill and across. And then we were to go to residency number 4, which was from Chattanooga, around up to Clary, and back and around the hill to Olness, you know, and then up the Steese, and then the tunnel through the hill into Goldstream Valley. So it was interesting, and I spent most of the season as a assistant engineer. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about Russians.
Yeah.
And found out that their ideologies and ours, there's no use trying to get along with them, because the ultimate to them is just to commit suicide right at the at a moment of glory was ultimate. That was his greatest thing. Now, he had been kicked out of Russia. His family had practically all died, all killed. But he was still a Russian. It didn't make any difference if there was a Russian anywhere in the country where you have to know. Maybe they couldn't talk the same language, and many of them couldn't communicate. We had a lot of Russians here, because they came in the early days as strikebreakers, see?
Yeah.
Oh, it was interesting. Well, I was one of the engineers got on a drunk out of the tunnel there where the engineer cracking up there where the monument is, you know, on the highway, Chief Highway. And so we had to take over that agency and try to find out why the ditch was 3 feet higher down there than it was somewhere else, we found it. And, but we had to stay at White Horse Smith's restaurant. We were the only patrons that he had. And you had hot cakes, pretty bad hot cakes, and a little butter and jelly on them. And you had scraped the flies out of the jelly because he couldn't see very good. And I just thought, what the hell am I doing here? And here come a car. I was walking out over, I forget, just going for a walk, I guess, there. And here come a car behind me, and they honk, and they says, "Hey, you want a job?" I says, "Hell yes." And it was NC Company. They wanted to know if I would want to come to work there. So I worked there for 6-7 years. But I was going to school nights there, and that gave me a better. When you're out in the bush, right,
you can't do anything.
You learn about Russians and the little engineering and so forth. Oh, yes. This is what has made fascinating life in Alaska to me,
is
that you have opportunities, more opportunities today than we've ever had.
Absolutely.
But very few people take advantage of them, and I think that's I guess, the whole thing. Betty has going on. Well, she could have got her citizenship papers, you know, and she married to me. Just automatically, if she wanted to.
Well, you could,
She didn't. She done it the hard way and learned a lot, and she corrects me for my spelling and everything else, which is good, but she's, this is what I'm trying to say, is that the opportunities are there, and if you want to take advantage of them, it's up to you. But that's more or less the gist of the philosophy of life. And if a person has the time to read and there's been lots of things. Lots of things I shouldn't have done.
Yes, like I'm wrong to get. What happened after you worked at MC then? Is that when you...
Then I had a chance to go as an insurance investigator, and that was kind of fascinating. And I had a cousin who was a lawyer in Portland, Oregon area. And he was always trying to get me to come down there. I read law for a couple of years under Julian Hurley here. I just couldn't go it. Good business, but you have to be so unscrupulous.
That's right. Absolutely.
And to be successful. And I couldn't take that. I don't pretend to be a saint by a long way, but I mean, there are limits, you know.
I hope to smile.
Yeah,
however, I do realize not everybody sees it that way.
It's interesting country to pioneer in, I guess.
So you came back up here?
Yeah, I came back up here.
You had the land?
Huh?
You had the land, and you...
Well, my brother and I bought another piece of land from this professor that couldn't get his hobby raised up in the Arctic. He went, couldn't get his citizenship papers because of the foul-up, you know. A lot of people in Alaska, even today, are ineligible for citizenship because of having entered down the Yukon or down the White River or some other place. And how can you prove what happened? Nobody around, you know. And it's unfortunate, especially when they wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I always figured there was some other ways that they could accomplish that.
Well, I think so too, Al. I always think, because usually if you persevere in these things, and especially in those days, because they were so anxious for... It
wasn't until about... in the 20s or 30s that there was clarification made so that some of these chaps, you know, especially the Russians and Montenegrins that came in here strike breakers in the early days, and some of them, one boatload, came right directly from Vladivostok to Valdez, and they unloaded them there and let them hike into the interior, and they had no way, you know, but they finally set it up so that by having witnesses, their entry and so forth and so on, like, they were eligible for citizenship. So many of them, and just shortly before they was ready to die, we were able to homestead or gain title to some of their property. But there's a lot of them that didn't do that.
So you homesteaded in here too? So you virtually homesteaded here?
I've taken up two different homesteads, but I dropped them. I had one of them right about where the runway is there at Wainwright. And there's a young chap there. Got married and wanted to have some ground, and I couldn't possibly use it. My brother and I had though more than we could possibly use anyway, and so I signed it over to him. And shortly after that, the army come in and bought him out, and he was able to go down on Chena Ridge area somewhere and re-homestead, you know, save his rights to homestead. So I never did use up my rights. I've often thought of doing that, but I don't think that would go over too good unless you had electricity and everything there. Why? You know, it's too late anyway.
Oh, I don't know. You said something that really impressed me when I first met you.
It would be fun, but I mean, it wouldn't do any good.
You know, when you talk that now you're 76, right? Is that it? Somewhere in your 70s, somewhere. How old are you?
76? Now I'll be 76 in February.
Yeah, no. And when I first met you and I asked you if you still did any painting, and you said, no, I don't have time. I'll do that when I get old.
Well, I've got lots of sketches.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a whole bunch of sketches.
In other words, you don't consider yourself old yet?
No. Age is nothing to do with it too much. You get a little weary, all right. Today I got tired, and before lunchtime I was ready to take a nap or something, get jolting on that tractor. Betty's out mushrooming and all kinds of business, and she's busy all the time, and still trying to wait for a call from the kids and so on.
Well, getting back to you, so after...
Well, as an insurance investigator was more or less to help carry the freight while I'm reading law.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of years of that, I thought, my God, you're taking on somebody else's trouble. I think I've done a little good. But there was just too sparse a country to be like some of the agencies that are operating today. And so I kind of let it go. But they always a little sideline mining, you know, and especially learning a little about possible part of what an atom should be and so on, and what was possible. A lot of that started over little argument over the shroud.
Hmm.
And the shroud, according to Professor Britt's theory, was that it was caused by a blast of atomic energy to imprint.
Mm-hmm.
So he was always trying to verify that in some way. No way to do it. Yet my daughter picked up, she was in, that's the one in mm-hmm. Tennessee, she was alerted to this, all the kids were, even the grandkids, of the consequences of the power that we can't see, no one can see, and most people can't imagine, and you're probably not going to be able to prove it either. But that rock there is an indication of possibilities. You've seen that one back over there. And that was supposed to be possible to do these things, but it has to be a tremendous blast. And you'd have to be able to know, the soul would have to be able to regulate this and take advantage of it. In other words, it brings on the thought that this life is a small part of the overall picture. And scientists wouldn't agree with you on that, you know. So as far as myself is concerned, I've had so many experiences that there's no question, but I'm not going to try to prove it to somebody. Betty and I have had similar experiences that she doesn't need any proof either. But if you forget about the little worries here and remember that there is something far greater that to look forward to, but try to be part of it and not be something that is going to be cast aside. Now, this is getting into a far-out subject, you know. Better leave that alone. I had an experience on the river one time when I was coming up. Everything I had was tied up in a boat and a barge. And I've done pretty well on that trip that season.
Was that first?
But buying mm-hmm. car, trading. But I run into a situation, I had my sister was on the boat, and had the head of the Pioneer Lodge, who was president of Eggville Number 4, and deckhand. And out of a clear blue sky, the clouds came over, it was just black, and we had quite a ways to go to anchor up. And the boat, the barge, 30-some feet long and about 12 feet wide, and the boat was about the same in back. But I had two wheels, and one connected with a steering apparatus so the barge could turn, yet the boat, mm-hmm. power boat, would be headed this direction, so I could turn it in any direction. The only way 60, pretty near 70 feet of boat to be able to turn it, especially around some crooked bends. And it began to get dark, and water was swept. And all along the bank, there was Blow Manly Hot Springs the other way, all along the bank there was these darn sweepers and trees over here.
Yeah, so you couldn't go in.
That was real bad, and by golly, pretty soon it got so you couldn't see where you was going. Light was no good. I had searchlights, but they were no good.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the two boys out on the front of the barge, and I said, "Now keep me organized here, because I can't see a blessed thing." Mountains on one side, and that caused the big hills, I should say, wooded hills, and that big shadow, and the black sky, and these darn sweepers, and every once in a while there'd be a root sticking up, you know. And I said, well, there's a good chance to get the Lord to help on this, because it just looked like just keep going and hope that nothing would happen, the motor would stop. And everything was fine. I said, keep to the left, a little to the right, sweeper ahead or something, and they finally were rounding this long bend, is about 2 miles around the bend, and we headed right kind of towards that hill, and you couldn't see a blessed thing, you know. And I said, well, we'll keep sounding, and that's about all you could hear over the noise of the motor. The barge just turned like that, and I thought, my God, what have I hit now, you know? And I couldn't rectify it. And all at once it turned and went the other way. And they said, that's fine. Shut her off. And my rudders was not doing anything at all. But we'd come around, missed the big sweeper, mm-hmm. missed the big roots that was in the river, and it made this figure S and landed in kind of a little lagoon on the edge of a gravel bank, and here's a big old tree that had been washed down, and it was roots anchored in there, and they tied the barge up to it. Now, when things like that happen, you know, and you can't see what's happening, and the motor shut off at that time. I didn't, well, then I turned the key off, but everything was planned. You can't help but think that there's some, you see what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you don't tell people about this because they say, oh, you're too far out or something.
Have you ever had the same sort of experience a sense of adversity, and then out of the adversity, an awareness of being channeled in slightly a different direction that would never have been, you'd never have been aware of if it hadn't happened?
Well, I think that, I think that shows the difference between paying attention to the guidance or trying to live your life all by yourself. Difficulties are usually difficulties that you bring on yourself in one form or another, or something that is within your ability to straighten out right on the start, but you misunderstand perhaps. I know that happens all the time. It's like somebody saying something to you and you misinterpret what they say. But and maybe it goes on and something is not done or something done that shouldn't have been. It's hard to put the finger on any one particular incident, but I know it happens probably daily, and some people, why, it's a near tragedy. But I think this guidance that is available to everybody, I like to look at it from a stand like Marcus Baugh. I don't know whether you know him or not, but he's a great theology a writer and a researcher. He has studied all over the world, different religions. Trained also as a psychologist and psychiatrist, but a good writer too. He is able to explain better than most people, most writers. But his, I think, idea is that is legitimate. That you have the opportunity to keep from having any incidents that are going to interfere in any way or cause mishap, difficulties. But you have to be very much aware all the time of teachings of Supreme Being. And the idea of Supreme Being is not just God as we refer to him, or Jesus, or Son, or Allah, or various other ones. They're all connected within your knowledge to understand, if you want to. But the choice is a free choice. I like that approach.
Yeah, I can go along with that.
So that's a fascinating, very fascinating subject. We've had so many instances of where difficulties have been avoided. And I recall one time that would emphasize a need for study and so on, being open, not have to pay too much attention to what somebody's written in the manual, of wanting to go up the river. And I forget why it was that we had to go up. It would have been better, perhaps, if we had waited a few days. Maybe it was because the water was low, or maybe it was high, I forget. Or it might have been the condition of the motor. But you get stubborn, and you go anyway. You're going on your own. You're not going to get the help. And I remember I got about halfway up to where I was going and in the evening, and the motor conked out. Unrepairable. It was a magneto that just burnt up. Well, what are you going to do? Here you are halfway, and work that I wanted to accomplish would have been to use the motor with the power coming back with a load. And it was, as come to think of it, was a contract for power poles for the Army. Mm-hmm. And they were long poles, and the motor would do the job, tow them. So you get bullheaded. Well, if I went back to town, I would have not met my commitments by being up there and so on at the proper time. And if I'd continue on up, why, what am I going to do? I have no power to come back down. Dilemma. Foolish. I had better have waited another day and seen that the motor was right. Didn't do it. Yet I had a feeling, maybe a guidance, or maybe it was just a hunch that people talk about so often. Don't go today, wait till tomorrow's late in the day anyway. So I poled the boat on up. I got up there about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the next day, why, instead of bringing the load down, why, I ended up by walking down and getting parts and then walking back. And that meant coming up the highway and going for miles and through the chin. That's a little more than 9 miles. And miserable, you know. Rain and niggerheads to crawl over and ponds to go through. And how foolish it is, you see. Well, nobody was really hurt. But it's a waste of time, and it caused confusion to your workmen, and didn't accomplish anything. In fact, I was a day late in getting the darn logs down there and up on the bank for the contract, but they didn't penalize me on it. Just those kind of things. And this can happen many, many times, you know. You want to do something, or somebody talk you into doing something, stop and think it out and say, ask for guidance on it. Mm-hmm. And it usually will. Now that can apply to health or finances or anything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's really, I tell you an instance that would apply to me, mm-hmm. and why there's really not much to add. I was going into Pioneers, number, oh, that's been quite a long, quite a few years ago. And one of the men in the Pioneers who was reviewing qualifications and applications had, there were 3 of them on that board, and the one in charge who, at that time that he told us about it, Betty and I here, well, happened to be president of the organization. I won't mention his name, but he's a pretty nice guy. Him and his wife was out and had a cup of tea, and he says, you know, funny thing, here you've been here a lot more years than I have, yet I brought you into the Pioneers. It's funny, isn't it? But he says, that reminds me of a funny little thing. I was on the reviewing committee when your application came in for membership. And you had on there, retired. And I says, retired? He's never done anything to retire from. He says, how come you put that on there, retired? And I think that more or less sums up what's happened. To me, in philosophy, I have never done anything to retire from.
But
Betty got a big kick out of it. You're busy all the time, but you're not doing anything, you know.
You said somebody told me once, you told me you had a band, or you started an orchestra. What was all that?
Oh, yeah, well, they had an orchestra here one time, and that was in the early 30s. And then somebody came in from the States and I forget who it was now or the circumstances, but they wanted to compete, and they had brought their own little 3 or 4 piece band in, and they were going to cut prices and everything, and at least once or twice a week was that was about all there was to do here. Nobody had much money, you know. During Depression, why, everybody just tried to be happy.
So
have as much fun as possible.
Dance band, yeah.
Yeah. So, there was quite a bit of confusion about this little layout, wanting to take over all the business. And there was two or three feel-good musicians here, wonderful drummer, all these people out of this world. And he kind of resented them coming in and wanting to cut prices and just take over, just to keep alive. And he was talking with me about it, and he said, well, why don't you put out better music? That's all I have to do. Yeah, but you can't get people to get it. And I said, let's try it. So I talked to the two good musicians. Charlotte Ames was just wanted to break into that sort of business on piano. You've heard of her.
You know.
She's still playing on. And Rose Manweller, the teacher, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
Her brother was going to college out there, and he played the slip horn, travel trombone. Billy Stroker,
mm-hmm.
First National Bank, he tutored a trumpet. Oh, a few people like that. And the college kids, they didn't have the money to play with either, you know. They didn't have to walk to work, but they were close to it.
Mm-hmm.
Times are tough for a lot of them.
That was in the 30s.
Yeah. So we went ahead and just ended up with about an 11-piece band, and
mm-hmm.
and we tried to put out some music that you couldn't help but dance. And it got involved, and pretty soon it ended up for 3 or 4 years that way. And then, I don't know, we also started the original Sourdough Dance Club downtown. And
mm-hmm.
I played fiddle in that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was, to me, it was a lot of fun. But the kids all appreciate it. I say kids, because they didn't have this extra little money to play with. And $10 or $15 a week was quite a lot of money in those days.
Yeah, still is. I mean, to have this for your
you
own
betcha.
To play with,
yeah.
God.
So that was more or less the way it got started, and we kept interested. Buddy was at a homemakers meeting a couple of years, three years ago, I guess it was, and there was one of our local clubs, I forget what they call it now, but they had a guest once a week would come in and give a little talk. One of them happened to be Mrs. Ed Clausen. And I knew her husband real well, and I had met her, you know, just, what do you do? But the elder family, one of her sons is runs a clothing store there by the old fire hall on Cushman.
Oh, I know one you mean. Yeah.
Cy Clausen is a real fine chap. But his mother was giving a talk, and she was telling about the early days in Alaska, and she said, and not only, oh, they said they had an orchestra here, and went on and on and on, but she said, when they started, you had to get up and dance. She says, it was just a rhythm that you had to dance. Mm-hmm. And she says, not only that, they weren't wearing sweaters, but they'd have tuxedos on and so forth and so on. And I don't know whether Betty Tipper they were talking about us. They said it was all the Buzzards, Millionaires, Nighthawks. We had several different names that went by over the years. You know. But I couldn't help but laugh. And then I happened to think of looking down there, and she was rather a short person, and rather not fat, but I mean she plump. And many a time I remember then that at least once a week or so, I'd see them go by, and they'd always be happy looking. Well, that was the reason for doing it.
What better reason? I mean, what better reason?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Filled in the time. And there was always so much going on, the benefits for this or that. St. Joe's Hospital was always open for help.
Mm-hmm.
We put on a Hosey Ross, who was the undertaker, and he was also a Hartford insurance agent here in Fairbanks for many times, one time attorney, and one time drunken stage operator, horse stage operator to Esther.
Mm-hmm.
And he quit whiskey when he done that, everybody thought, my God, stay away from him, you know. It was an attitude, ex-drunk, he'll try to implant you. But he wasn't that way. He ended up a millionaire. Very fine chap. Excellent. I talked with him when he went out on his last trip up. We had talked for about an hour in the National Airport the whole time. Wonderful person. But funny how you lose the train.
Oh yeah, that happens to me all the time.
But anyway, he and my older brother and a boy by the name of Roden Davis, myself, but Hosey Ross was a spark plug, because he was on the city council at that time, or on the school board at that time, and decided that the kids had to have an area they could play basketball. Nobody had any money. No, couldn't get a dime out of the council. So we decided to put on a benefit show. And they got a bunch of old-time plays and worked them up, skits, you know. Then Bernie Stone, the editor, the Newsminer, done the advertising for free. Come time for the program, and everybody turned out, because it was a benefit deal for raising money to build a gymnasium. And in the meantime, why, Hosey on his own, by his own resources, went ahead and started in buying local lumber and getting carpentry and so forth, and was approved by the rest of us. But he went, so he had the money, you know, and he would contract to have the work done, and it wasn't a short while until the darn building was up. So we put on this play to pay off the indebtedness, materials, and labor. Well, everybody turned out, and one of the acts, and you've probably seen it, was where you have a table with a hole in the top there, and you get a dark-haired person underneath, and light-haired one over here with stiff collars on, and you have a big old saber and dress up, and brother was about 250 pounds then, and we dressed him up with a towel around his head and a bad big flowing curtain or something around him, and And he was going to execute some fancy stuff, you know. So he cut the head off of the blonde boy and carried it under a napkin over and set it down over the hole on the other end of the table, and up comes a dark-haired boy, head up to the hole. Well, after he got done with that, he was supposed to reach down there and grab the curtain that we had around the big table and expose the trick. Well, he had a hold of his own sash when he got around there and walked on off the stage. And here's nothing. People wondered what it was about, and they were so astounded, and everything was so silent. And we got to thinking, maybe this would go over a second time. So we put it on again, and we made more money the next day. A real good chap of ours, a friend of ours, an elderly man, had his whole family there. And I remember seeing him come in, because it was like, Hiles, you know. If ever you see him, no matter where you see him, anywhere in Alaska. And here, the second night, they're sitting right down front, right in the very front row with all the little kids. We pulled the trick, but this time he made sure that he got a hold of the curtain, so he exposed the trick. And he came to me after the show. He said, you know, that was a good trick. But he says, I seen it last night, and I knew it was a fake. He knew
it. But he came back to the
show. Yeah. But these kind of little incidents.
Oh, yeah.
We had another one that was, I darn near got killed the second night on that, too. This Roden Davis, one of the four, just the four of us is all, plus people, music, you know, and mm-hmm. singing and things like that. But was a big, broad man with a turtleneck sweater on and a slouch cap, and he looked like he was a typical thug. So Hosey, everything was so simple, no money attached to it. See? And we had a little table there on the stage, and Hosey's sitting down there, the curtain opens, says, I am getting so tired of the book agents. You've probably seen that a dozen times over the years. And book agents come in, I just don't have time, and I'll get a hold of somebody and see if we can't arrange. So he called up on the phone, and short while I hear come Roden Davis, and he looked horrible. Well, I had a board, and I had it all in the back of my pants fixed so I wouldn't get hurt, and I had a 1x4. And I had it cut here and there so that you whack with it once and the darn thing would break. Well, it worked out fine the first night. Somebody substituted a 2x4 for that 1x4 the second night, and I was a book agent. And
boy, then that's awful.
And I came in there and I tried to sell Hosey a book, and he had it planned that shoot him, and he gave him a cap pistol, you know, a pistol with a cap in it. And when he shot, well, I had something reached up and took it, a little pebble or something, and I threw it out in the audience and coughed like that and threw the pebble out. And so then he got a cannon, stovepipe, you know, and a little powder and a lot of smoke when you touch it off, and he wheeled that up there, and I kept on talking, and he shot that, and I had a billiard ball in my pocket, and I he's like that, and I threw it out and rolled down in the audience. Never got it back either, part of the equipment. And So that didn't work. I kept on talking. Then I was supposed to beat him to death, and he darn near done it. I tried to get him to stop, and the crowd was laughing, and Hosey couldn't hear my protest, but he says, "I did see tears in your eyes." Oh, my God, I couldn't walk for a week. So I paid dearly for that mistake.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
Gosh.
But he tried to break, he was supposed to break the
one
before, and he tried awful hard. My God, he's about a 250-pound man.
Holy smoke, that's just terrible.
Still feel that, you know.
Oh, gee.
All little things like that, but it filled in the time, and made it interesting and not just bearable, but kind of enjoyment.
Because at the same time you were raising vegetables and just keeping alive and doing.
Oh no, we didn't start this vegetable. Now in the early days we did have a garden. Oh yeah, on the old ranch down there, we had.
We've
done real well, you know. We had stock and of all kinds and. Oh, there's a lot of horses and animals and.
Well, where did you?
A real good business. There was money to be made in it, you know, and we had a.
That was the dairy farm.
Yeah. And we raised together, had to have about 200 tons of hay put up, and that supplied a little employment for some people, you know. And but that every day delivering milk around, not like stores didn't carry it in those days. They didn't have the refrigeration facilities that would take care of it. And bottle redemption and this and that. Mm-hmm. So it was a door-to-door operation. But we got real tired of it, and so we decided, well, are we going to go fishing? And Bob pulled a coin out of his pocket and flipped it, and as he said, we won.
Mm-hmm.
So we sold out. We'd have been probably much ahead if we hadn't have, you know. But
financially, but that's not everything.
But that launched us on everything from prospecting and mining again to fishing and hunting. And he was a registered game guide and spent the rest of his...
About what year was this when you had the dairy and you sold it? Did you have your family then? And your
about 36, I think we was clear out of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Took quite a while to get rid. We had a lot of beef stock too. And altogether, I think we got rid of on that episode. We got rid of about close to 70 head of stock.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Oh, that's all right.